Episode 1118, My Strength is My Story with Tara Cousineau, The Kindness Cure.
Moms, needing a little inspiration and a ray of hope? You've come to the right place. This is the show that you can turn to for just the pick-me-up you need. This is Create Your Now, Your Best Selfie. Here's your host, certified life coach, personal trainer, and nutritionist, Christiane Wargo. Staring at a
stop sign, watching. Happy Abby Day. It is my favorite day of the week. It is My Strength is My Story series, and we have a doctor in the house. It is Dr. Tara Cousineau. She has written a brand new book, The Kindness Cure, and I promise you there's a golden nugget buried within our chat. Oh, you're going to want to stay tuned. Friends and family of Tara's, welcome. Those of you who are brand new to Create Your Now, I'm so delighted of your presence. If you already haven't had the opportunity, you'll want to head on over to createyournow.com where you can learn more and sign up for the Kisses newsletter, the Keep It Simple Strategy Everyday Solutions to Live, Love, and Impact. Well, in a moment, you're going to hear the long list of accolades, achievements, and accomplishments by Dr. Cousineau. She is filled with information, and this brand new book that she has put out, The Kindness Cure, really sinks to the heart of what I believe we need to kick off our new year with, how the science of compassion can heal your heart and your world. We combine mind and heart together. There's this connection. And I've got to tell you, you've got to listen all the way to the very end because Tara shares a part of herself that you will want to hear. These stories go deep. They are going to melt your heart. And as I told you before, you will find a golden nugget throughout this entire episode. So without further ado, let's welcome in Dr. Tara Cousineau, The Kindness Cure. Hello and welcome to Create Your Now. Today is My Strength is My Story series, and we have on with us a doctor. Yes, we have a doctor in the house, so you better get your pen and paper out because you are going to learn lots. Now, I got to be honest with you. I read her name and I about freaked out, but let's see what we can tell you all about Dr. Tara Cousineau. She is amazing. She is a wife of 23 years and is a mother to two beautiful daughters. She is a clinical psychologist, meditation teacher, well-being researcher, and a social entrepreneur. Tara founded Body Mojo and develops wellness tools for youth. And they're digital, I believe, but she can tell us a little bit about that. She's affiliated with the Center for Mindfulness and Compassion at Cambridge Health Alliance in Somerville, Massachusetts. Tara is a mindfulness trainer and chief science officer at Will, a digital mindfulness company, and serves as a scientific officer advisor to kindness.org. Woo! Dr. Cousineau adds author to her long list of accomplishments with her brand new book. Oh my gosh, we've gone digital here, so let's see if this works. The Kindness Cure, How the Science of Compassion Can Heal Your Heart and Your World. Woo! Tara, I don't know, I'm exhausted.
I'm exhausted too. I don't even think my family knows that's my bio.
Woo! I'm just like, I don't know where you squeeze in your daughters and if you even see your husband. And we even left a few things out because we'd be here like forever. I mean, you write grants and oh my goodness, I don't know. And then to have all of these names and stuff with it, I'm surprised I didn't butcher it more. But I have read your book. I love your book. And in our world today, we need more kindness.
Yes, we do. Yes, that's why I wrote it.
Well, before we jump into your book, tell us a little bit about what keeps you moving besides writing and children and family. What keeps your schedule hopping?
Oh, gosh. Well, first of all, thank you for that bio, but really that long list of things has just kind of accumulated over about 25 years. So I don't do all of that at once. Let me just say that a lot of my life has been raising two daughters who are now sort of, you know, coming of age, 17 and 20. So I'm sort of like about to be an empty nester. But I think what keeps me going is after sort of lots of practice and fits and starts is I sort of start my day with kind of a very specific routine to kind of just get my head and my heart in the right place. And that wasn't easy at first when I had toddlers and they're running all over the place, but sort of over time I've just like, okay, what's going to center me? Because I'm not going to be a good, kind, caring mom, wife, or psychologist if I can't actually start from a really calm place. So I think what keeps me going is having a little morning ritual. And then I take yoga class like 3 to 5 times a week.
Wow. That's awesome.
It's the cheapest anti-anxiety on the market.
I love that. Now, for someone who's listening who has never taken yoga, because some people will come from the perspective of, oh, that's woo-woo, and I wouldn't even try that. And for our men who listen, they might be like, I'm too masculine for yoga. It's all female. What would you tell someone who really has never experienced yoga?
Oh, my gosh. See, I don't see it as one of these woo-woo, you have to be in perfect shape to do. Yoga, the essence is breath. And yoga are just postures that are applied to the breath. And so I have, as you have imagined, a very, very busy mind. It's hard for me to shut down and to sit in like a meditation pose. Oh, forget it. I actually need to move. So for me, yoga is really, sometimes I just call it a body prayer, or, you know, it's just mindfulness in motion. And yes, there are different kinds of stripes and colors when it comes to yoga techniques, but the essence is you're almost like training your brain and your body, excuse me, to just down-regulate. And it's not about being super flexible or athletic at all. So I think that for me, it's just sort of become, it's a place where I can kind of come home to myself, really.
Mm, that is beautiful, because it makes sense, even in your book. And I read all these stories, and oh my goodness, you all are going to want to pick up the book just for the stories, because they're inspirational and you will learn from them, just the stories themselves. But then Tara goes way deeper into that, and we'll get into how she's written every chapter so you understand that this is more than just a, you know, words on a page. It's something and a way for you to actually apply it to your life. And so in reading your book, Tara, it, you know, you calling it home, bringing yourself home, it's also allowing yourself to come into kindness, to prepare yourself so you're not that grouchy monster that's approaching your day every morning.
That's right. You know, I mean, kindness, you know, really starts with yourself in a lot of ways. I mean, it's cultivated, obviously, in relationship. But I think that one of the things that happens is that when people are really in a state of distress or stress, you're really kind of operating your day-to-day life from that fight or flight reaction. And I don't know if your listeners know that. I'm sure you've talked about it before at some point, but you know, the fight or flight response is our natural reaction to stress, right? Like we want to either avoid it or we run right towards it to do something about it. And it's really hard to maintain that level of energy, you know? So we can't really be kind to other people or ourselves when we're in that kind of frenzied state of mind. And so I just really came to the conclusion over the years that unless we can really learn how to ignite our calm and connect system to offset that fight or flight response, it's really hard to draw on our natural instincts to be kind and compassionate. So we have to start with ourselves.
Mm, that is beautiful. That is, okay, just listen to that about 10 times over every day, and that's going to shift your mindset right there. How you put it, we need that calm and connect. And in our society today, I don't care if you're turning on the news, the radio, if you're looking in your Facebook feed or your Instagram stories, there are all crazy things popping up around the world. And the world truly needs a cure. And your book has presented something that, well, I don't think there's any other book that's out there that truly talks about kindness. So for us, Tara, a little bit, before we go even deeper into some of the chapters in your writings and stories, define for us kindness so we're all on the same page.
Oh, sure. My definition is super simple. It's not scientific at all. You know, I write in the book, and I say this to people, that kindness is love in action. And then people are like, well, what's love? You know, because that's like such a big term, and we have so many conditioned beliefs around love. And, you know, love is just really being connected to other people and to understand that we all belong to one another. So kindness is really about, you know, putting love in action. So whether that's applying that to yourself or your neighbor or your children or your coworkers or bigger things that are going on in the world, it's really coming from a place of love. And kindness essentially is, you know, well, for me, it's both sort of this loving presence, but also an orientation to life, people who really cultivate kindness and compassion, they just see it everywhere because they've sort of trained their mind to be able to be aware of it.
And in your book, when you were writing, the stories that you share, there's a lot of them that in there that are personal. But there's mm-hmm. also a lot of them that you have either they were patients of yours or they were somehow you all connected in your scope of your journey. And what was one of the themes throughout the stories that you noticed that stood out the more you talked to people when it came to the kindness cure?
Yeah, there are 28 short little stories or vignettes in there. And, you know, it's hard to say that there was one connecting theme other than love. It's almost, I think that people that came to me with their stories or whose life stories I observed and watched flourish really came to a very deep understanding that how they think about themselves and how they think about the world really matters. And these people all had a shift towards, Albert Einstein, I feel like, was really a mystic other than a science. But he had this one saying where, you know, the most important decision that we ever make is whether we see the world as a friendly place or a hostile place. And I would say that the stories in my book are of moments or experiences where people could actually shift from that sort of reactive place, seeing as the world is potentially a bad place, and really seeing it as a loving place, and that there's an opportunity to connect. So in a way, it's not only the feeling state, the emotion, but it's almost this like real shift in perspective of how you see humanity.
Wow. A lot of us live our lives very reactive. We don't take the yoga practice, the posture of breath, and just kind of breathe in and go, maybe this isn't really directed at me. Maybe there's a bigger picture, to shift the perspective, to shift and say, you know what? They're not coming from a place of love, but I can.
Absolutely. One of the hardest things for people to grasp sometimes is just to actually not take everything so personally. we aren't actually the center of the universe, but we get into this sort of like state of mind where people are doing things to us, right? And somehow it's about us or it's about hurting us. And really, most of the time, it's the other person's stuff, right? And so taking that pause or that sacred pause to be able to really kind of almost infuse yourself with a little bit of fresh oxygen gives enough distance to say, what's going on here? Is this about me? Or is this about something else that's going on that I really have no control over, right? Mm-hmm. I only have control over how I respond. That's it. It's hard for people to grasp, but once they start practicing it, it's like, okay, this isn't about me. I don't need to get so upset about it. Right?
That's right. Like when we're driving in traffic on our way to work, it gets kind of crazy and people are very aggressive and we don't know why they're aggressive, but the person who's seeing all of this happening, then they think, oh, well, he thinks that I was going too slow. And then it all becomes just reaction after reaction after reaction instead of pausing. And I love how you term it a sacred pause. If people are in a reactive state, because I think, unfortunately, we live that because of our busyness. You know, how are you? Oh, I'm fine, but I'm so busy.
Right.
That's like one of the first five words to come out of our mouths. If everybody is just in that state of reactive, and about ready to go off, a stick of dynamite that's just, you know, the fuse is lit, and any moment it's going to blow, what would you tell them as to kind of to talk them down away from the edge to say, you know what, you don't have to be reactive. There's more to life than maybe what you're seeing.
Well, I think the first thing that I would like to point out is that our reactions, our reactivity is absolutely natural to us. It is our first defense, line of defense, really. Our bodies respond to, energies and things that happen in the world. And, our bodies are really sort of these wonderful emotional radar systems. Unfortunately, we don't see them that way, you know, we go right to our head and we start evaluating and judging, right? But if we're having a stress reaction in our body and we can stop long enough just to say, oh my God, my heart's pounding, or I'm getting sweaty, my jaw's clenched, my fists are clenched, is to actually say, oh, what's going on here, right? You're in fight or flight mode, essentially. And when you can understand that your body's doing this sort of first automatic response to the world, then you can notice it and do something different. So, you know, the first line response is often reactivity, but we don't need to stay there. We don't need to stay there as long as we do. And it's a practice, I have to say, because it's sort of a mental training. Like we need that reactivity, mm-hmm. you know, and our brains are designed to scan our environments for danger, right? That's sort of the reptilian brain.
Yes.
You know, and so it's like, well, how do we get out of the reptilian brain, you know, to kind of like evolve ourselves a little bit forward, but just to know that we can't help it sometimes, but we can intervene much quicker than we often do by practicing a sacred pause, breathing, redirecting, realizing, oh, this isn't really about me.
Mm-hmm. That's good stuff. When I first got your book, I was like, really? You're going to tell me how to be happy. You're going to tell me how I should treat my children. You're going to tell me. And I thought, I don't know. And I don't judge a book by its cover, literally and figuratively. But when someone would look at your book title, The Kindness Cure, someone may say, I don't get it. How is this really going to help? So I got to ask that one question. How did you come up with that title as to what you really wanted to do and how you wanted to get it out to the world, your message?
Sure. Well, I address your concern because people really have a kindness phobia, so I want to get to that next. But the sort of the spark for me was actually a personal event. My daughter was going into her senior year of high school. All the kids, you know, they went to go and hang out and party the night before school started, you know, against their parents' wishes. But, you know, what can we do other than say no? And they do it anyway. But anyway, so she was at the wrong place at the wrong time. And she was leaving the gathering and was physically assaulted by another girl. Like not like, you know, the little, like, you know, pulling on the jacket. It was the, you know, punch in the face, the cat scratches, the bloody nose, the whole thing. And I was really surprised because I actually knew who the other girl was. And I was like, what is going on? Like, you know, it was one of these things, all this other, you know, stuff, to be kind, is going on in the world. But here's this little tiny incident that happens at home. And I just was really kind of taken aback. And I was actually more taken aback at my own reaction because the tiger mom came out and I wanted to go like bust down that mom's door. I really did. I mean, I was like, oh my God, are you kidding me? Like, really? Instead, I drew on the sacred pause and I actually waited like a week to kind of really even do anything. Because first, you know, ask my daughter, I'm like, are you okay? Do you feel like this will happen again? Do you feel safe at school? Like, what a way to start out the school year? You know, all these kinds of questions. And she said, you know, Mom, I don't know why. You know, she just kind of chalked it up to like literally a middle school grudge in a way. And said, you know, this girl, she's got a really hard life. You know, a lot of hard things have happened. And I said, yeah, I know. I actually do know that. It's still not really an excuse, you know? So we need to kind of figure out how to respond to it. I have to say that my daughter was much more compassionate than I was at the moment. but it was one of these, it was like a slight little thing and it was this little trigger for me. And really the question that popped in my mind is like, what happened to kindness? Like, where is it? Where is it in our daily life? Where is it in our culture? You know, we have this cool to be cruel culture. And it's really been sort of amplified over the years, in part by social media. And now there's a blessing and curse of social media. I mean, social media is doing wonderful things now, right? The Me Too movement. There's lots of important messages that are coming into our awareness and our consciousness that need to happen. But there's also the flip side, you know, where we just, as you mentioned earlier, we're overexposed to negativity, we're overexposed to violence, we accept it more, we kind of numb ourselves to it. And we have to be really mindful of that. So that one incident just kind of sparked this, not really an insight, but an awakening for me In part because I know that we can cultivate kindness and compassion. It actually changes your brain. And I was like, how am I going to be this messenger of, listen, if we can practice these simple skills every day and kind of build up our kind of neural network, our circuitry, to really enhance our instincts for kindness and compassion, this world would be a better place. Mm-hmm. But when we're in that reactivity mode, it's almost impossible.
You're right. You're totally right. And you all are going to want to pick up your own copy of The Kindness Cure, How the Science of Compassion Could Heal Your Heart and Your World. Whoa. All right. So you mentioned kindness phobia.
Yes.
It is a phobe. That's a short thing. Kindness phobia, fear of, we all know. Talk a little about the kindness phobia, because it was interesting how you put it in your book, and I thought about different things. As a mom of five, I don't know what my reaction would have been if it was my daughter who was assaulted. It's hard for us to put ourselves in other people's shoes, but it seems like with technology, our digital advancements, we tend to now back away into corners and to isolate ourselves.
Yes, I agree with you. I think that in a lot of ways, modern conveniences have made it easy to kind of hide in our own little, you know, corners in a lot of ways. And we can easily tune out and shut out the world. And again, it's a little bit of a natural reaction in some ways, because we are overexposed, I believe, right now. And I'm not really, you know, I'm hardly online. Sometimes I feel so out of it, like I don't know what's going on in the world. But, you know, a lot of people, you know, spend hours and hours. I mean, you know, really 6 to 9 hours a day kind of exposed to, you know, technology, online media. We are just saturated. And there is a disconnection. And there's also another phenomenon in our world, you know, at least in the United States, where 1 out of 4 people say that they're lonely, that they don't have one person that they could call on to share their tears or their triumphs in the world. So in a way, it's kind of this paradox, is that are we more connected with technology, or are we really less connected? So I throw it out there as sort of a question. But the kindness phobia, I think, is that we've really just become suspicious of people who are kind. Or that kindness or compassion seems so elevated and unreachable that there are these untouchables out there. You know, we've got sort of cultural icons, Nelson Mandela or Mother Teresa or Gandhi, or, you know, or sometimes these altruistic heroes who, you know, will jump in front of a train to push somebody aside, and, you know, these saviors out there. And really, that's a very, very tiny, tiny, incy-beancy percentage of human beings. There's so many more people who are actually kind in the world. I mean, we wouldn't be surviving as a species if we weren't doing kind and wonderful and generous and thoughtful things every single day. But we don't see it, we don't promote it, we don't acknowledge it. And that's what we need to do. Like, we need to kind of amplify the good that's happening in the world, because I actually believe there's much more good that's happening than bad. It's just that our attention is being directed to all the negativity.
Very true. Yes. And then we get ourselves consumed with it, and that's where our thoughts go, because we're naturally sinful by nature. And when we, you know, just think negative, it's easier to think negative because it's almost a comfort zone. When you have to think positive, it requires sometimes more energy if you're not really wired that way, or you weren't blessed to have parents and raised by, you know, great people who interacted in your life, you know, with the positivity and hope.
Yes. Well, you know, I think that this is why I wanted to bring in a little bit of the science, because I feel like it helps people not to be sort of judgmental of themselves or other people when you kind of understand really how the human body and the human brain works. So, you know, if you know, our brain is unconsciously scanning the environment for danger, like, we're just wired that way, we'll see it. And some neuroscientists actually call it the negativity bias, that we have a bias towards looking for threat or things that are unfamiliar in our environment, because, you know, we want to protect ourselves and our loved ones and our kin, you know, like, that's what we do. Right. it does take effort, as you say, to move out of that state to one of caring and connecting or tending and befriending. And that's very much a part of our evolution and our nature too. But we have to actually move ourselves consciously and intentionally into that state of mind and allow it to, in a way, cultivate a positivity bias that kind of sits side by side. You know, we need both. But we want to be able to move from the negative to the positive more fluently, more conscientiously, and that takes effort. So the kindness cure is really about, well, here are these tips, ways to actually practically do it. It's not that hard. It's just, well, we kind of have to do it.
We have to do it. And you mentioned in your book about practice is progress. And I think for so long we were stuck on perfectionism and it was like practice makes perfect.
Yes.
But now the phrase is changing and practice is progress. So tell us a little bit about how you set up your chapters and your book so people understand that when they pick up their own copy, because of course we'll have all that information in the show notes, it's not just, again, words and paragraphs that aren't going to have meaning to their life. This is something that you can take and you don't have to read from front to back. You can read right in the middle or at the end and jump around. Now, I was kind of weird. I did front to back. But that just kept me organized because otherwise I'd be like, no, wait, where were we in the book when I read that? So talk a little bit about how you set up your book and how we can actually apply that and take your stories and, you know, apply it to our life.
Yeah, sure. I'm looking at my table of contents now just to remind myself, but there's four parts in the book. And the way that I really try to orient it is kind of to start from the inside out. So, you know, part one is really like, you know, being kind is part of our humanity. It's very natural to us. It's very natural to children. And, you know, we kind of get conditioned out of it. And so the first part of the book is like, okay, here we are. Here's the state of humanity. Here's what's natural to us. And the stories kind of just talk about people's almost natural inclination to be kind. And so there's stories of two little boys and a mom with breast cancer. And, you know, it's really about how, you know, we're wired in a way. Part two really goes to our caring mind, the brain. And I'm, you know, I'm a little bit of a neuroscience nerd, I have to say. And so my whole thing was like, how do I make this super simple? You know, because the science really is telling us, like, this whole concept of neuroplasticity, that our minds change based on experience, whether they're positive or negative, is so important. So, you know, you mentioned before, like, you know, well, you know, not everyone has had the privilege or the luck, right, to grow up in a kind, nurturing environment. Yes, that's true. I mean, believe me, a lot of my clients have had very traumatic lives and upbringing. But we can shift from being stressed to blessed by how we take care of ourselves now, right? And so understanding a little bit how the brain works, how our minds work, and sort of that push and pull between emotions and the mind, I think is extraordinarily empowering. It's like, oh, we can actually do something about this with intention, and it actually does change the structure of your brain. Like, I think this is amazing. It also speaks to, like, we really should be teaching empathy from, you know, kindergarten on up. We should be reinforcing empathy and kindness and compassion in all of our environments. School, parenting, workplace, leadership, because it is something that actually we can foster and we can grow. So, and then the third part kind of moves into really what I call kindfulness. So you mentioned that I'm a meditation teacher and, you know, I'm learning how to be a better meditation teacher when it comes to mindfulness. Like, I have to practice what I preach, right? Kindfulness is really being aware of the present moment with kindness. So, you know, mindfulness is kind of like got a big craze going on. You're seeing it on the cover of Time and Newsweek, and people get confused. They think, like, what the heck is mindfulness? Well, it's actually, you know, being aware of the present moment. And I like to emphasize the kindness piece, is that because sometimes when we're aware of the present moment, it might not be a good moment. So how can we step back and say, oh, I see. I can look at this without judging me or, you know, my experience or other people and just see it for what it is. And I'll hopefully apply some kindness and compassion. You know, we can't help ourselves when we, you know, get pissed off that someone just cut us off in traffic, right? That's natural, you know? So part three really goes into very practical ways to do that. So I offer some exercises and some mini meditations, which are on my website too, so that you can actually download them and practice them on your own. And also how we can start connecting with other people, which brings me into the last section, which is bringing kindness sort of out into the world, is broadening our perspective. And there I really kind of use this word called kindsight. And kindsight is really viewing life experiences with tenderness and understanding. We really beat ourselves up a lot. And often we don't even catch ourselves beating ourselves up. And when we do that, we're kind of unhappy, right? So when you're saying, okay, well, how is the kindness cure, you know, lead to happiness? Well, using some of these skills and strategies really will, because you actually have to start treating yourself like, you know, a human being, right? So, and then when we can do that, it's much easier to reach out into the world. And then the last stories actually talk about people, how kindness is contagious, how their experiences actually impact other people, and sometimes unknowingly.
See, you're going to want to pick up your own copy. I'm just telling you, it is chocked full. It is awesome. It is. It really is. I'm kind of the one who likes the nerdy part. I want to know the science too. I know the reality and I see what's real life, but to combine those, I think it's fascinating. And so whether you're a mom, a grandma, an auntie, maybe you're in high school and or in college and you're like, you know what? It's not too kind on campus. You know, the college years are a lot different than what they were when at least I was going to school, and I'm sure probably you can attest to that too. Life has changed a little bit, and so having the sprinkle of goodness, which is kindness, in your world and how you have placed it and combined it, I think is golden. I really do.
Oh, well, I so appreciate it. And, you know, sometimes I think about, oh, how can I really help create kind campuses? Because it is so true. I mean, you know, they can be crucibles of, you know, really nasty stuff, right? But I think part of it also is kind of going back to what we were talking about in the beginning, is that our culture has also cultivated this sort of ranking and rating mentality. And so being the best, being the smartest, you know, accumulating all of these achievements, you know, so that we can be better than the next person, you know, our culture reinforces that. And whether it's about beauty, brains, money, and it kind of just puts us into this like, oh, we can never be good enough unless we keep striving. And we really need to offset that. And just in part of it's just noticing that, oh, I just got caught up in that. You know, but listen, when you start applying for colleges, it's totally reinforced there. I got two girls, believe me, this whole college application process, I almost, you know, put me over the edge with how crazy it is.
Yeah. And the details that they want, you're thinking, are you serious? If they can afford to go and they have good solid grades, what does it matter that they have to have 20 things and has to be in three different categories if they're 20 things? I don't know. It is... Yeah,
it's a complete setup for stress, you know, and then we can't really then, you know, when we're so worried about ourselves and competing and ranking ourselves and, you know, it just becomes hard to say, oh, wait a minute, this isn't about me. I'm connected to other people. You know, life's so much more fun when we can like be in this together. So, it takes a little bit of stamina and effort to kind of move from, you know, being stressed to being blessed, I like to say.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Because this ranking and rating, it follows us everywhere. I mean, you're getting graded when you're in kindergarten, either you're doing well or you're not doing well. And then it just goes on. And then you've got social media. And then it bombards you. You even get graded when you're delivering a baby.
I know. Everything's great. Your credit score. I mean, you just look around. It's like, oh, my gosh. So it gets tough. Yeah,
it does. It does. Well, when I was reading your book, one of the things that stood out to me towards the very beginning of your book is a term that you called motivational empathy. And empathy is not talked about at all. I mean, maybe a few people you'll hear it, but it's not like that buzzword out there. Talk a little bit about how motivational empathy can be used to intentionally expand your awareness of capacity for kindness?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because I think people also make assumptions about what empathy is. And, typically it's like putting yourself in another person's shoes, right? Is being able to kind of feel what another person's feeling. And that's true in part, but empathy is kind of got, it's got some components to it. So there's like emotional empathy, right? It's like, so like, you know, the mom, you know, caring for her crying child, or feeling bad when a friend's going through pain, as we start to mirror the emotions of another person. And that's very much about our blueprint. You know, we emotionally resonate. Then there's sort of a cognitive empathy, and that's being able to put yourself in someone else's shoes, imagining yourself there, right? It has less to do with emotion. It's a part, you know, it's a part of it, but it's like we can actually transport ourselves into another person's situation. That's very good too. Now, sociopaths, they have cognitive empathy because they know how to manipulate, but they don't have emotional empathy. They don't feel, right? So there's kind of these nuances. And then there's motivational empathy moves us into this category where we can see and feel what another person's feeling, but not get trapped by our own emotions about it. So we can step back a little bit. And so I'm going to do the little neuroscience thing here again, is what they've discovered, I find so like beautiful, is that with these fMRI machines, like you can just get these pictures of the brain, right? And the empathy network in our brain actually maps over the same network as physical pain. So, you know, if you see someone step on a nail or get cut, right, you have this immediate reaction of ouch, or revulsion, right, in a way. Like you want to kind of move away from it. Well, that is so interesting to me, that the pain network and the empathy network can map onto each other. Because a lot of times when we see upsetting things, we feel horrible and badly, but we get so sort of hijacked by how awful that is, right? So to me, that makes complete sense. Caregivers, first responders who are seeing a lot of difficult things go into what some people call compassion fatigue, but it's actually empathy fatigue. It's that we've just been so overexposed, and then we begin to shut down, numb out, right? Mm-hmm. So moving from that state of emotional distress and moving into motivational empathy allows us, through pause, you know, pausing, being able to kind of stand back, getting a little bit of emotional distance, we can actually find it within ourselves to say, oh, I see that that person's in pain, but it's not my pain. What can I do about it? So it's sort of feeling for a person rather than with a person, so that we just don't get so overcome and then be sort of unable to respond in some sort of kind way. And I actually coined a term for myself in the book, and it's called, you know, it's being falling under a spell. So what was happening, so the situation happened with my daughter. She gets, you know, roughed up, and then, you know, we've got a presidential election going on. I mean, the news was just horrible that year. I'm talking about sort of 2016. And horrible things are happening in the world. Syria, babies being washed up on shores. I mean, honestly, I was like, I can't take this anymore. And I was feeling myself kind of sort of, you know, implode a little bit. And I realized it wasn't that that I'm not caring and that I don't feel for, or there's not, that I don't want to go and do something about it. So I think that what happens is that when we go into that natural self-protection mode, because the world seems so painful and awful, I call it self-protective empathy lethargy. I call it a spell for short. It's like we fall under a spell. And when we're under that spell, it's really hard to kind of move into a place, like we're in a trance in a way. So whether it's the world's pain or being flooded with social media or negativity in the news, we can kind of fall into a spell. So using some of the skills and techniques in my book, we can move ourselves into motivational empathy, which was your first question. And that is being able to feel for, right, what's happening in the world or in our families or in our lives, but to do it in a way where we're not trapped by our emotions, that we can feel like we can do something. And so it's kind of moving ourselves. I have a little grid in the book. It's kind of like being able to kind of move into a place of empathy and empowerment at the same time. And that takes practice. It takes awareness and practice.
Lots of awareness and practice, and that's why you're going to want to pick up your own copy of The Kindness Cure, How the Science of Compassion Can Heal Your Heart and Your World. I love your spell because I kind of went back to my childhood and thought, oh, he's going to cast a spell on me. And, you know, that imaginative thing of, you know, the witch and whatever. But we do that to ourselves. We also tend to put ourselves into a coping rut where we don't want to get out. How can we, you know, what can we do, and why do we go into a coping mode, and what's a way for us to kind of escape that? Because we hear the terms all the time of, oh, I'm just stuck, and I don't, you know, it's not like depression where, you know, they don't want to do anything. It's not that severe, but it's just like, I just don't feel like getting up, and Monday morning, Tuesday morning, doesn't matter what morning, I just don't really care.
Yeah, I call that spinning in place. You know, is that we start spinning in place because we're using the same coping strategies over and over again, and they're not effective. They might have been effective at one point in our lives, maybe when we were younger, another phase, but we start to form these habits, right? And so when we use the same coping strategies and they're no longer serving us, we get stuck. It's a very common experience. And so, you know, I try to see, like, you know, we actually wake up from a spell, to use sort of the fairy tale, you know, metaphors, you know, by love, right? If you think about the fairy tales and stories, you know, people, you know, who are going through the sort of the characters who are going through the hero's journey, right? They're taking a risk. They're something is really changing. Something becomes so important to them. And it's usually love and care and belonging, right? And so moving out of, you know, sort of that spin requires us to first to stand back. So I have these sort of like ingredients, like my own little potion.
I love those too.
And so part of the potion is, you know, I call the sort of the antidote to being in the spell is called, you know, Pepi. And so Pepi stands for these ingredients. And the first ingredient is presence. And this is what I was talking about, the sacred pause, is really learning to how to cultivate that state of calmness, even if it's for as short as 3 minutes a couple times a day. You just start practicing that. And then the next step is emotional regulation, right? We're so impulsive and reactive that we don't even actually attune to how dysregulated we are about our emotions. So it's like really cultivating, this is an important strategy for children, by the way. You know, if you think about toddlers, you know, that whole toddlerhood is about emotional regulation. It, you know, is that children can learn to sit with their uncomfortable feelings and know that they're going to be okay. Well, guess what? Grown-ups need to do that too.
Yes.
Right? We sort of just lose practice. And then the other piece is perspective taking. You know, that's a part of that cognitive empathy. It's like, you know, learning to how to kind of zoom out from a situation and try to get the broader view. And when we get a broader view, we have much more capacity to see all sorts, you know, of viewpoints, even if you don't agree with them, you know. But so, you know, perspective taking is really important. When we can kind of shift from that place, so those first three elements, the PEP part really kind of gets us out of that stuck place, and it really actually has to do a lot with the body mind. And then the next ingredients are like, well, when we are at a better place, when we've learned to calm ourselves down, all of a sudden we actually see how connected we are to the world. We feel a sense of purpose. We want to help. We derive pleasure from helping. I mean, research shows that even 2 hours a week actually extends life. Volunteering is better than taking an aspirin for heart health, really. And, you know, so just think about that. Okay, could you help, you know, with the, I don't know, can drive, you know, on a weekend, or a soup kitchen once a month, or things like that? It actually makes us feel better. It's really healthy for our heart. And then we start to integrate. We say, oh, we're just a part of something that's bigger, you know? We can sort of feel more like we're kind of with it and not so much in reactive mode. So I call that integration. You know, we're connecting our heads and our hearts is really what that's about. And then finally, not finally, because this kind of weaves throughout it, is that we have to put in the effort.
Yeah.
It takes effort to be kind. It does. Not a lot, but a little bit, and consistently. So that's how I see that we can get out of the spell.
I like peppy. It just all worked together. I was like, and then I kind of thought of pepper. I'm like, well, this, you know, if you're thinking of the spell and the, you know, I don't know what cartoon it was like years ago, but you know, you get the big bowl here and the witches, you know, turn it on the black and then put in the spices, or spices are peppy. I love it. It really does stick with you. Well, I want to talk a little bit and bring in some of your stories. And one of them happened to your daughter. And I thought it was sweet. I could somewhat identify with what happened with her. It was in the area of the kindness warrior. And you share a story about Josie and the mice.
Yes.
So if you don't like mice, plug your ears for a few minutes. But it really is a sweet story.
It really is. So Josie's my younger daughter, but I think this episode happened when she was about, I'm going to say 13 or 14. And it was the same year that three horrible things happened in the world. We had the Boston Marathon bombing. You know, that was about 8 miles away from where we live. There was the Colorado Batman Aurora shooting, if you recall that. And then the year ended in December with the Sandy Hook children massacre, right? And so in our household, we were like, you know, oh my God, you know, what's going on in the world? But I just want to paint that as the backdrop. And also that the kids, I don't know if your kids have experienced this, but we're having like, you know, sort of, you know, these drills in case a shooter came into the school. I mean, so this is like now the new norm is having these, you know, lock, drop, roll drills. And so that was that's the background, right? Not anything that I necessarily grew up with at all. So this is a new and more common experience among children today. So that was the backdrop. So here we are. It's fall of maybe freshman year, high school, and she's on the track team. And the kids after school were jumping in the long jump sand pit, and they came across two little like newborn baby field mice, just kind of tucked in there, and like this little sort of like, you know, kind of nest, you know. And Josie comes home from school, and she's like, "Mom, we have to go back and get the mice." And I was like, "We're not going back to get the mice." And like, you know, I'm like, an eagle or a hawk has probably gotten the mice by now. And she was like, "No, Ma." And literally, like, she would not let it go. And then she went to, you know, the computer. She looked up how to, you know, feed mice.
Of course she did.
She tugged me, you know, she was tugging me. She's like, "Mom, we have to go to the Walgreens. We have to get Pedialyte." Well, I don't know what Pedialyte is, but we have to get Pedialyte. And I have a paintbrush, because you can't use a dropper. You have to use a paintbrush, and you put the paint drop, you know. I mean, she had the whole recipe. So what was I going to do? You know, it's starting to get dark now. It's 7 o'clock. I'm thinking, oh my God, these field mice are not going to be there. You know, my husband and, you know, my other daughter were like rolling their eyes like, okay, you know. Anyway, so we get to the field. She runs across with the tissue box, you know, and she's just darting across the field, and they're there, and she's waving to me like, "Mom, they're still here." She puts them in the box. She comes back over, you know. She opens up the Pedialyte. She feeds them with the little drops, you know, and I was like, oh, my gosh. And, you know, we're in the car, and she just kind of, like, pauses and says, "You know, Mom, I know that you and Dad, you know, sis don't think that these mice are going to live. But at least I'm doing something about it." And it just made me want to cry, you know? And I just thought, oh my God, how can we stuff out this child's natural inclination to be caring and kind in the world and really feel connected, actually, to the world? It was a real lesson for me. It was a real lesson for me. So yeah, and she had sort of that sense of fierceness of, that's why it's the chapter on the kindness warrior, is that this is natural to us to want to be kind and caring, you know? And she really demonstrated that for me. And it really started to change my orientation on how I said things, you know, sort of like the sarcasm that we can get into in our lives. And, so you know what, children are our teachers.
They are.
It's cliche, but it's so true.
It is. And we get old and we get stuck in our ways. Okay, not that we're old or anything, because we're not old. We're just as young as anything, right? Sure, we'll go with that. But they do. They are teachers. But the thing is we shut our minds down thinking that we know everything already. We're going to live it because we got it. We've already made it, and no one's going to teach us anything else. And walls go up and we're finished.
Yes. Yeah. We get into that trap. Mm-hmm. That's the spell.
Yeah, it is a spell. We got to break the spell. And it's all about Peppy. I could just talk about that. And I'm going to have that in my mind the whole time. The kids are going to hear about it from me. You know what? You're casting a spell over yourself. I'm going to be like, Mom, what book did you read this time?
Exactly. I get that question all the time, by the way, from my kids. Like, okay, Mom.
Yeah. Go get a life, Mom.
Now it's like, what podcast did you listen to, Mom?
I know. I love it. Just lots of information. Okay. So here's another story that I found important and I thought probably rang really true with you. And maybe that's why you pulled it out and put it into your book. It was about the story of Christine, a cancer patient. And you, as a meditation teacher, you work on mindfulness. You're part of a scientific officer and advisor and all of this. I'm like, this makes sense. I talk about mindfulness and mindset here and on our podcast all the time. And a lot of what we do in our life deals with, you can't take out the brain. It's ingrained in everything that we do, our actions, whether they're nonverbal or verbal, whether they're, you know, motivated by physical or finances, whatever it is. Talk a little bit about Christine and what she did that was just so unique and actually somewhat drew her family together in the process of her battle with cancer.
Yeah, you know, her story is such a simple story, and that's why all the stories are simple because these are not extraordinary acts. They're just very intentional ones. So Christine was diagnosed with breast cancer. It was a real shock to her and her system. She was a marathon runner. She was a health coach. You know, she was doing everything right. And so she gets this diagnosis, and it really threw her for a loop. And not only that, since she was more of, a health nut, the whole process of going through radiation treatment was really sterile to her. It was unfriendly. It was unkind. And so what she describes is, you know, that she had the first appointment every morning. So for 33 days or so, she was going for radiation treatment. And so she would go into this little room. She would have to undress, put the shirt on, and then go in, have the radiation treatment, and then leave through another door. And so women didn't see each other. There was no sense of community. You know, they were, you know, she got it. It was like confidentiality and privacy, but there was, she said it felt like a factory. Like literally she was like walking into a factory. She called it the cancer factory. And so what she decided to do, in part was almost more for herself in a way, is that she started to leave little sticky notes. There was a little like 4x4 inch mirror in the dressing room. And so she decided that every morning she was going to leave a sticky note, some sort of positive note, affirmation for the next woman that was going to come in to the dressing room. And then what happened is she had three teenage kids, three kids like between maybe middle school, early high school years. So they got on board. So they started going out and finding positive statements and writing them down. So then it became this sort of family experiment in a way. You know, and she says, I don't know if any other woman saw that note. She said, but I would just go in the next morning, take the one from yesterday down, put up the new one, and hope that maybe, you know, it made some other person feel better. But in any case, it made her feel empowered and, importantly, her kids, you know. So that's compassion in action, right? It's not about trying to get something back. It's just about doing something that feels from the heart. And so she sort of exemplified that.
It's a beautiful story, and I get goosebumps. I mean, I got goosebumps when I read it. Got goosebumps again when you told it. It just, it's one of those that's heartwarming, but it's like, it's so simple. Like you said, it's not like she had to go out and spend a lot of money. Her impact, she will probably never know her impact. But
exactly.
I guarantee she impacted many, many women, you know, during her treatment times.
Yeah, it's a ripple effect, you know, and if it doesn't land right for somebody, that's okay. It just gets passed over. But for somebody else, it will land, right? So, yeah.
Exactly. Well, we could talk forever, but I want to throw in one more story because I think I wouldn't say it's an interesting one, but because we're coming off the holiday season, I thought that it would be one that we would want to talk about. And I think it's also important we hear the term and the word forgiveness, and that we need to forgive. And some people They say, well, I can't forgive because that means I'm accepting what they did to me or what they did to my family member or my best friend. Or I can't forgive, whatever. There's all these stigmas even around the word forgiveness. You talk about it in your chapter, and it's the Christmas kidnapping.
Yes.
Share a little bit about the Christmas kidnapping.
Okay, I'll try to keep this short, but the backstory is that when I was a child, my parents got divorced. We were the only family with divorced parents, and so there was a lot of actually shame around it at the time. And my dad wasn't exactly the best role model, let's just say. And so our holidays were split, right? I mean, actually, some things haven't changed. It's still like, you know, you split things 50-50. And so Christmas Eve, we celebrated with my mom, and Christmas morning, we celebrated with our dad. And so this was like really like the first or second year post-divorce, and he was still very angry. And so essentially, he picked us up Christmas morning to, you know, take us to his apartment to open presents and have a meal. And next thing we know is we're on a plane across the country to visit relatives that we didn't know. And he left a letter for my mom. This is not totally all in the book, but, you know, and no cell phones, no computers back then, you know, and it was a really frightening experience. And I was about 10 at the time, and I knew that this would devastate my mom. And so it was just one of these moments where people can just be so cruel, right? And it wasn't about me or my sister. This was all about my dad, you know, getting revenge. But I was really angry about it. And other things that accumulated for many, 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 many years. And I was holding this sort of resentment and grudge towards my dad. I mean, there was a period of time where I didn't even speak to him for about 8 years, like in my 20s. And through my own work, I just, you know, at some point I really realized that I was holding on to the anger. And the anger was harming me. And it was harming my relationships, how I saw romance, how I saw marriage, like, so it just was a complete distortion, but it was I that was holding on to it. So I started doing forgiveness practices and a lot of sort of, and this is, I'm having to tell you, this happened really late in life. Like, I could have saved a lot of grief if I had just worked on this much earlier in my life. But that's life, right?
Right. And that's why you're sharing it in your book and why it's so important.
Yeah, because it's so common. I mean, so many people hold on to grudges. And, you know, it's like if we forgive, it's like we're giving in, right? You know, my dad never sort of paid, you know, well, he actually never paid for anything, but he never paid for the distress that he caused the family. And, you know, but for me, I had to do a number of things. And so there's a forgiveness practice that's in the book, which is sort of actually from a teacher mentor of mine, Janet Connor, and I love it so much. And it's called Releasing Your Prisoners. And basically, it's imagining, like in your mind's eye, who are you holding prisoner? Who has hurt you? Who do you have a grudge against? Who do you feel shamed by? You know, and our prisons can be pretty full. And so the practice is essentially, you know, allowing yourself to say, enough. And instead of saying, I forgive you, which can be very difficult for people to do, it's the stem of forgiveness in Greek is actually means to untie the knot. And so this little exercise was so helpful to me. So it wasn't that I forgive you, Dad. It was like, I untie the knot. I untie my relationship, my connection to this anger and resentment. That's what I'm untying. And that is a beautiful gift. And I'm telling you, once I did that, my relationship with my dad changed. And I didn't see him that often. He was in an assisted living home, you know. But when I could see him, all of that past completely went away. You know, it just literally almost dissolved. And so that I could actually, I saw him a week before he died, about 2 years ago, and we could just sit there. And there were many lovely things about my dad, but I had chosen to kind of shut them out. You know, he was from the Midwest. He loved country Western songs. You know, he always had good tapes in the car. You know, back then there were tapes, you know. But, gosh. Oh, totally. But you know, we sat together and we just crooned songs to a CD player. And, you know, he held my hand and he just said, you know, you girls are the best thing I ever did.
Aww. What a beautiful blessing.
Yeah.
Yeah. A beautiful blessing. And to think that now you're gifting that blessing, Tara, to so many other people who are sitting here going, I've been abused. I feel lost and shamed. My marriage hasn't worked out. Maybe I lost a child. Maybe I made some bad decisions growing up and I haven't even been able to forgive myself. The gift that you are giving these people in writing your book and being vulnerable and sharing not only other people's stories, but your story, personal stories that you can tell there was some pain there. But now, just like you said, you've remapped it, and
yes,
you've changed it.
Yes, well, I mean, it's a beautiful thing to be able to do that. It's a release. It's healing, and it just makes it so much easier to move through the world. You know, it really does.
Mm-hmm. It does. Well, when people pick up their own copy, what is your hope as the author of it? What is your hope that they will take away from it?
Well, that's a good question. I think that my hope is, one, to know that, you are a beautiful soul and that bringing love and kindness into the world has an impact, even if you can't see it, and especially on yourself, and that, we have kind natures, and it just takes a little bit more effort sometimes, than we think. And so to go out and practice. And see what happens.
I love it. Go out and practice. So I know people are going to want to practice because they're going to want to connect with you. So where can they find you and say, oh my gosh, I want to, you know, get on our newsletter. I want to learn more. Tell us where they can connect.
Oh, sure. Well, the easiest way is come to my website. So that's going to tarakuzno.com, and you can take a little kindness quotient quiz there. And if you take the quiz, you'll get on my email list. You'll also see my book page there, and there's going to be some bonuses as the book comes out, where you know, buy a book, send me the receipt, I'll send you free meditation downloads and things like that. So there, you know, in social media, you can find me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. I'm just learning all of this stuff now, so
you're getting, I'm a little younger.
I am. I'm a little slow in the uptake, but I'm trying. and, you know, and of course, you know, you can find my book on Amazon too. So all of those online things. So.
Right, exactly. Well, of course, we will have all that information in the show notes, because I know you're going to want to pick up her book. And it's so colorful. I just love it, even in the digital format. Isn't that pretty? I just love it.
I know. You know, I don't have a lot of say in what the cover is, although I didn't like the first version of it. And then when they came back with this, you know, with this one with sort of the pastel rainbow colors, I see them as sort of like the energetic colors of, you know, the light prism. My 17, Josie had said, oh, Mom, that is so much better. I love it. I was like, you do? I'm like, all right. I guess the marketing people know what they're talking about. So that's what it is.
That's what it is. Well, it is exciting because you finished your book. You've done a lot of work. And one of the things you said in your book is kindness is simple and sacred.
That's my motto.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a beautiful motto to have. All right. So before I let you go, I have one last question for you. This series is called My Strength is My Story. What has your story gifted you?
My story? Oh, I just think that we have the capacity to live beautiful lives when we can see each other as human beings. Mm. You know, I think that it's so easy to feel separate. And separated. Yeah. And actually, I think for me, what I've learned over the years from my upbringing, my family, so many clients who struggle in the world, is that once we recognize that we belong to one another, the healing happens. Mm.
The healing does happen. And in your book, when everybody gets their own copy and they read it, they're going to see all those stories and how it all comes together and ways that they can apply things to their life ways that they can help benefit other people's lives and reaching out and extending the cure, because you may have the answer, but if you're not, you know, giving it as a gift, well, you kind of have to fault yourself at it too. So I think the kindness cure is something we need to resurrect. And I am so glad, Dr. Tara Cousineau, that you took the time to put pen to paper and bring us an incredible heart and mind connection, because we do belong.
Oh, Christiane, thanks so much for the opportunity. You're very inspiring. Thank you for sharing my story too.
Thank you. Many blessings to you.
Feeling inspired, ready to train for life and love your journey? Visit createyournow.com for more incredible resources to help you along the way. We'll see you next time on Create Your Now, Your Best Selfie. And remember, always be sure you consult your physician before beginning any health and fitness plan.